Okay. Now we're plugged in. Right, so if God creates something, that doesn't necessarily mean that it will be it's needed. God has needed to have it to continue. There's two points, parts on the spectrum of existence. There's the transition from non-existence to existence, which we call creation. So in order for something to exist, it has to have a transition. Of course, there's nothing there beforehand. So we're not using the word transition from it being in one state and then going to another state. It means that God has to will it into existence. But once it willed into existence, if God's will doesn't continually will it, it will expire immediately. But the very fact that the world did not exist at a certain point in time and God willed it, so that shows you that the universe did not have necessary, what we call necessary existence. It does not have to exist. The only thing which must exist is God. That's the only existence that, by his very nature, he exists. Existence is not something which has to be given to God by something else. That is synonymous with his definition, that he is an existence, that he exists. He never had to be brought into existence. Okay, so but when God creates other things, a person might think that, well, God can create it, but once it's in existence, it'll now live by itself. So that's what the second point Rambam, Maimonides, makes, is that the continuation of the existence also is necessary, that it's through God. But, and then the question came up that why does it say a third statement that, and from God is its continuation? Well, it seems like we just said that. We said, number one, that God causes everything. Fine, so let's put that aside. We agree that God caused everything to come into existence. But then he makes two more statements, that in God, in him, is the sustaining of everything, and from him does it continue. So it sounds like it's redundant. I mean, if you already told me that in God is the continuation of everything, so what are you adding by saying that from God does it continue? So I was discussing this with Rabbi Mann, and he said the second one, so the first one is as it applies, it means to say, like we said, that it is necessary for the existence to continue that comes from God. But a person might think of it like the view that Aristotle has, that like a shadow of a person. So without the person, you won't have his shadow. So in a certain sense, he causes the shadow. But his shadow is not due to his will. That's what Rabbi Mann says, the third part, that a person should understand three things. Number one, that God caused everything to exist. Number two, he sustains their existence. They cannot continue without him. And number three, that continuation, that sustenance, is through his will, his very intent. As opposed to Aristotle said that there's no intent, it's just a natural result, that once God as God exists, so the world exists. The world is like a shadow to God, according to Aristotle, which we don't support that view. We say that God willed, it was through his own decision. It was his will that exists. But I had suggested...
Rabbi?
Yes?
Rabbi? I'm confused about something. You made a very beautiful point about if there cannot be a shadow unless there's an actual person, thing, God, whatever, the world. It cannot make, a shadow cannot exist unless there's something there to create the shadow.
Yeah.
Could you just expound on that a bit more? I'm trying to grasp it and I'm not able to.
Yeah, Aristotle's view is that the world existed along with God simultaneously. There was no subsequent act that God did and then brought the world into existence. So he says they were simultaneous. But we don't hold that. We hold, of course, that God existed prior to everything, and he willed the world to come into existence.
Right.
So that's what the third...
That's the of creation.
Right.
That Hashem
right.
created.
Right.
And the 6 days, and right. we have the seventh day of Shabbat. Okay.
So,
Aristotle has the other view. I don't understand that, but okay. I don't know why he would have that view.
Right. Okay.
Makes no sense. Thank you very much, Rabbi.
Rabbi?
Yes.
So is our support for that position the story given in Genesis, or is there some other support?
That you can take a look. I think it's page 200 in the Guide for Perplexed. Let me get it and I'll read it to you. Hold on.
Okay.
I was wondering the same thing, Doug, because, like, who do you,
what was your question? Francesco, is that you?
He's rabbis. Pardon?
Who just, somebody had a question or no?
I was just telling Doug that I agreed with him. I was wondering how you would logic prove between the two, the two ideas, which one was correct.
Uh-huh. Okay. By the way, Naomi, who's online, Naomi, you want to check your the control panels on your computer to try to increase your system volume. All right? If you can't hear the volume well, try to do that. I have everything turned up as far as I can hear. Okay. All right, so on page 200 in the Guide for Perplexed, so Maimonides says at the end, he says this following, I'll just read him verbatim. Owing to the absence of all proof, we reject the theory of the eternity of the universe, and it is for this very reason that the noblest minds spent and will spend their days in research. Meaning he's saying, since there's an absence of any proof for the eternity of the universe, even the greatest minds, the noblest minds, will spend their days in research. Because it's a very intriguing question, but it will never be answered, according to Maimonides. And he says, he continues, for if the creation had been demonstrated by proof, even if only according to the Platonic hypothesis, all arguments of the philosophers against us would be no avail. If, on the other hand, Aristotle had a proof for his theory, meaning the eternity of the universe, the whole teaching of Scripture would be rejected, and we should be forced to other opinions. I have thus shown that all depends on this question. Noted. So, now Doug, give me your question again.
The question I had was, is the only proof that we have against Aristotle's position, in other words, that God did proactively create the world, is our only proof the story in Genesis?
Well, according to Maimonides, he doesn't seem to be calling it a proof, because he says, owing to the absence of all proof, right? So we reject the theory of the eternity of the universe. And he says that if the creation had been demonstrated by proof, meaning if, evidently it hasn't been demonstrated by proof. And if you go through the chapter, it starts on page 199 in the Dover edition. And he explains why, his reasoning. Because he says, accepting the creation, we find that miracles are possible. Meaning to say, and he says also that every difficulty in this question is removed. Because if God did not create, and it's just a natural result, so then it's not something which is governed by God. It's only through the fact that God created the world and endowed properties that he can then suspend those properties, which is what we call a miracle. He can give properties to water, and then he can suspend those properties and part the waters when the Jews needed to go through, and every other miracle. So he says that based on that, we can now accept miracles. But if it's something which is simply a natural result, so that means it's not something which is under God's hand to control. So the stories which we have, which we know are true, this is what attests to the fact that creation had to be true. So if you want to talk about proof that way, that would be along the line of proof, and he's using reason. You see, you know, my mind is very objective.
Do you know, just broadly from a historical standpoint, if Maimonides lived after Rabbi Ben Vakuda wrote Duties of the Heart?
He was after. I think
Maimonides was after?
Yeah, hundreds of years. I think Ben Vakuda was, as a matter of fact, I know historically that somebody mentioned that Maimonides' father always had the book Duties of the Heart on his desk.
Okay. Because he has a three-part proof of the existence of God in the first chapter, which I think the second part of that could be expanded to prove that it would be impossible for the universe to have existed in its current form always. But I'd have to go back and play with it a little bit.
Isn't part of that proof, Doug, that if the universe eternally existed, we would never reach our current part in our current time in history, because you would go infinitely back and never reach infinitely forward?
Yeah, that's the piece, Jim, and that you can't have sort of an infinite set of little finite pieces. Of which we're all finite pieces. So that was the part I was thinking of.
I think there's also the impossibility of an infinite series of events.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. All right, so if you take a look, it starts 199. You can go through where it talks about his objection to the Aristotelian view. Okay. But I think there's one more thing that I had suggested to Josh, my understanding of what Maimonides was saying. And that is that what is so crucial about this first principle, that God is the exclusive cause for everything? So the question that I had put, and we actually discussed it yesterday in Shul, on Shabbos, I brought up to my friends. So we get together every Shabbos and we take a topic. So this one, I was you know, mentioning to them about the discussion I had with you and with Josh and Cal. And the way I put the question to them is this: is if God had created angels or natural forces, let's refer to them as natural forces, and these natural forces now govern the universe. So, and it's not God willing every single drop of rain to fall at a certain angle at a certain time and so on and so forth. Like Rabbi Chait, his brother, Rabbi Chaim Moser Chait, he wrote a nice article recently. And he explained how one of his students asked him, you know, they were discussing this point about the student was of the opinion that, or was asking, is it that when every single time a zebra gets killed by a lion, God wills this lion to kill that zebra? So that would be very pleasing emotionally, that, you know, God is controlling every single thing. And of course, that would extend to God would control every leaf falling in every single tree in the universe. And it's a certain angle that the leaf falls and the speed that it falls and the time it takes to hit the ground, all these different minutiae. Are they controlled by God or not? So Rabbi Chait, explained to the student, well, where would the justice be? I mean, why would the animal, God will this lion to kill that zebra as opposed to another zebra? Is it a punishment? Did the zebra do anything wrong that this one has to be killed as opposed to that one? And using that approach, he showed that that can't be, that can't be applicable. And it's natural law. It's also greater wisdom, too, that God can create a system that can function on its own. So if this is true, which we say it is, so why can't God create the natural law that governs existence? It's just one more area that God would delegate to the forces that he created, just like he created forces of nature and forces and with how animals operate. So then create a force and that governs existence too. So what I suggested is that you can't say that. And that's something which is the one thing which is unique to God. It's exclusively in His realm, under His hand. And that's because an angel or a force of nature itself had to be created. So by the fact that it had to be created, that shows that it itself cannot govern creation. So the area of creation, of something coming into existence, is different than any other quality in an object. In terms of whether something is moist or has a certain shape or color, that God creates certain laws that will govern that. God will create the laws of how water operates. And that will continually, control that. Just like God can delegate to human beings free will and they can now operate on their own. So just as we have autonomous capacity, so also these forces can work, autonomously. All right, but in terms of existence, that's not something which can be delegated. That's something which God did of His own. There was nothing else around except for God when He created, when He did the act of creation. So therefore, creation, by definition, is the one thing which is exclusively under God's control. Right? That's important to say, because that's the first principle, that He is alone the creator. Nothing else has that role of creator.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Just so I understand, you're saying that God directly is, like, unlike the laws of nature that He established to run things, you're saying that He is directly involved in creating and maintaining existence?
Yes, in terms of existence, that's right. And that's actually a verse in the prayer. We say that God, Hamachadish B'tuvo, that He renews every day, every single day, the works of creation. What does it mean that He renews? Let me see if I can give you a source on that. And what's the meaning of that statement? We say it in the evening prayers. Let me see if that's... Even in the morning, is my mistake. Maybe it's the morning. A sec. Yeah, we say in the morning. We say the following. This is right after Baruch Hu blessing. He who illuminates the earth and those who dwell upon it with compassion and in His goodness renews daily, perpetually, the work of creation. Okay? So that's what we say. So in terms of existence, right, that's something which is under God's control. So that, and that's what I believe that statement makes says there. That I believe that Rabbi Rosenthal had referred to that as a proof. But all other things, all other properties of an object. You look at an object, any object, it has numerous properties from shape, its physical structure, height, weight, color, temperature. It also has existence. Existence is also a quality of an object. But that is different than all other properties. Because that's something which God created, did Himself. Without God's will extended to an object, so then the object would expire. So it's that's...
Rabbi?
Yes?
May I ask a question in reference to measure for measure, the theory of measure for measure, that God is ultimately the one who is in judgment of us. In terms of measure for measure, if we do something incorrect, for instance, it'll come back to us. I was reading something that one of the rabbis, Rabbi Avigdor Miller, had said. A question was asked in reference to why did the earth open up and take Korach and his sons and swallow them up? Because Korach opened his mouth wide, so the earth opened its mouth wide. But Hashem created the earth and created that event. It didn't just happen. How do we look at that? Is it correct to believe that theory? Measure for measure.
Measure for measure.
That God has the ultimate judgment.
Measure for, well, that's, it's not really on the topic, but measure for measure means that when God punishes, he always punishes in the exact area of the fault of the person. That's what that means. One, he uses the same midah, meaning the same trait that the person has made a flaw in, so that's where God's going to correct the person. He's not going to correct them in something else if they didn't express.
Mm-hmm. Is it true that would apply to the animals like the lion and the leopard? If one, or the tiger, what you were saying earlier, that one killed the other, then is there judgment with the animals as well?
No, there can't be. There's no sin by animals, so there's no judgment by animals.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay, that was a puzzle. Thank you.
Okay, so... The point is that in terms of existence, it is something which we're saying is that's from God, but all other qualities can be delegated. All right, so that's, I just wanted to bring it up because we had discussed it last week. I just thought I would mention that. All right, Francesca, is that clear?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. So I think it's because the proof would be that. That was the one act that God did prior to anything else. Nothing else existed yet. So therefore, if he's doing the act of creation from nothingness, that's something which is totally dependent upon him and nothing else. Other things he can give the ability for autonomy, that they can function a certain way, just like a human being can make decisions. And it's not being coerced by God. So forces of nature and angels, they too can function, but only within... certain, just like we could only function when there's certain, we have limitations as far as how far we can function. We can't function outside of the, our design. And a person cannot lift a mountain. It's outside of the design of a human being, the structure and abilities that they can exert that much force. All right. Okay, so we're back in Koheles, unless there's any other questions on this. All right, so we're in Koheles. We're continuing now. The last verse we did was 7:5. Now, 7:5 really is the beginning of a series of verses. So let's read it again, and then we'll see how it's all tied in. Okay, so 7:5 reads as follows. It's better to hear the shouting, the rebuke of a wise man, than to be a man who listens to the song of fools. 6, and whoever has the, if you could just put on your mute buttons, if you don't have your mute button, no, just press mute. Thank you. Okay, and 6 says, and this is a very cryptic type of a verse. This is the hardest one, I think, in the series. He says as follows. For as the sound of the thorns under the pot, meaning when you have a pot and you use the thorns and twigs as your fuel to burn and to cook your food, so as the sound of those thorns that are crackling as you cook, so also is the laughter of fools. And this too is futility. For the oppression makes mundane a wise man, meaning that it lowers his level. And a gift destroys the heart. That's 7 and 8, verse 8. Better is the latter end of a thing than its beginning. And better is patience than pride. Okay, so I'm going to stop here, and you'll tell me why I stopped there. Take a look at those 4 verses, and we've got a bit of work in front of us, but I got a couple of days we can work on this now. I don't know if any of you have to go anywhere.
question about just the facts on verse 7?
Yes.
So yours said I'm looking at Judaic Press, and they translate that as, for the taunt makes the wise foolish, and it destroys the understanding, which is a gift.
Right, that was
the
one
second
view.
Part?
Yeah, that was one view. I saw that too. That is Swarno actually says that. He says that, how does a gift destroy the heart? What does it mean? He says, at certain times it'll happen that a person will err in his intelligence that was given to him as a gift by nature. Okay, so that's what you're saying. I think there's another view on that, that the gift... I mean, the plain
Rashi holds that it's a positive.
Yeah, he says the same thing. That the heart of a wise man, that is a gift to man. As he quotes his other book, he says that God gives forth wisdom. So what he's saying is that oppression. But how is oppression going to reduce the wise man and destroy the heart that was given as a gift? What type of oppression is he talking about?
Okay.
So he says, Swarno says, it's talking about when a person removes himself from being involved in thought to enjoy a little bit of laughter and joking around with his friends. So he says this is wasted time. That doesn't mean that a person is wise should enjoy laughter, but you'll see that the rabbis say in the Talmud that there was a certain rabbi that he used to start off, I think it was in the Talmud, a certain rabbi, he would start off his classes with a joke to his students. And he said this, he'd do that because it opened up their hearts to listen to the rest of the lesson. They'd feel good and they'd feel like a certain camaraderie. You know, when a person jokes with you, a person unconsciously feels flattered by it, that person is joking with you, is taking time, he wants to put a smile on your face. So that naturally makes a person respond with he likes the person because of that. You made me laugh, my response is going to be a warm response. I think that's the underpinnings of that emotional response, is because there's a sense that that person was doing something for you. He wanted to make you smile. He wanted to make you laugh. So you like the person. It's not just that you like the joke, but you like the person, because underneath you sense that there is an interest in you, and that's why he took time to make you laugh. But even the jokes that the wise men give are intelligent jokes. They're not just the waste of time that King Solomon is talking about here. But there could also be another explanation here where he says, and we'll see if it's true, when he says in 7 that the destruction of the heart is through a gift. So we'll see if that is...
You asked the question, why did we stop at 8?
Yeah, why did I stop? I'm asking if you could tell me why I stopped at the end of 8, not even further.
One possibility would be that verses 6, 7, and 8 are observations of reality, whereas 9 becomes directive. 6, 7, and 8 say make observations about the world. But 9 starts to say, don't do this, do that, that sort of thing.
Okay. Well, you'll also notice that verses 6 and 7 start off with the word because, which means that they're connected. That means 6 is connected to 5. So if I say 5, better is to hear the rejection of the wise man than to hear the song of fools. And then 6 goes, because the sound of the thorns crackling under the fire, da 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 da, right? It's just like the sound of, is equivalent to the laughter of fools, which was a futility. And then it says again, 7, because. Because the oppression will make mundane, will mitigate the wisdom of the wise man. But then I believe he gives his theory in 8. That's why I stopped after 8. I'm trying to point that I believe what he explains in 6 and 7, and even in 5, he finally gives a theory. He tells you facts that are true, but then there is a theory which applies to all these. And the theory is better is the end of something than the beginning. So what I'm suggesting is that verse 8 is not going to be, will explain why these other things are true. So what is he saying in 5? Again, and keep the rule in mind that whenever he teaches something, it's because you might have thought otherwise. So he's redirecting a person from a false notion to a true notion. And that's what we always call the Hava Amina in Aramaic, in the Talmud. So the Gemara is always concerned with, what would I have thought prior to this that you needed to tell me this new lesson? So it's always important to deduce from a new lesson what it's trying to correct in the person. So if 5 tells you that it's better to hear the rebuke, the shout of a wise man than the song of fools, it's because you might have thought that it's, since a song is much more pleasing to a person emotionally than to be told that you're wrong, to be ridiculed. So King Solomon says, no, the ridicule of a wise man is much better. It's better for you than to hear the songs of a fool, because you might have thought otherwise. And he says, and he continues in 6, and he says, like the sound of the crackling of the thorns underneath a pot that's cooking, so also is the sound, is the laughter of the fools. Now, of course, there we're going to have to explain what's the analogy. It's just so far-fetched. It sounds like such very elusive. Why is he talking about thorns of a pot? And how is that akin to the laughter of a fool? What's his message over there? And he says, this is also futility. And then he says, again, there's one last lesson, is that in 7, the oppression mitigates the wisdom. It reduces, it makes mundane the wise man. And it destroys the heart or wisdom that was given as a gift. So we can go with that way, as Doug, as you quoted. And also, that's what Sforno says. But evidently, a person would want to hear the laughter of the fools. That's why he's telling you not to go for it in 6. And that's why he's also telling you in 7, that when you, the Oshek, I mean, if you oppress wisdom, if you don't, that's what he means in the Sforno says. What does it mean, oppress? It's going to reduce the wise man. The oppression means that he's not involved in thought, just so he can have a temporary laugh. So he says, that's not good. And it destroys the heart that was given as a gift. How does it destroy the heart? How is wisdom mitigated? Because the person took off time to joke around with his friends. And that's what he thought. He says clearly, he says that the time the person will restrain himself from thought in order that he can laugh with some wasted, with some futile matters, people that just joke around about things that have no value whatsoever. So this destroys him from being involved in thought.
So it's the main idea then that somebody who's mostly into gaiety is basically involved in a futile end, futile result overall.
Okay. So he's involved in something which is futile in all these cases, right? But what else can we say is going on? I mean, look in 5. What was the Havimina? What was the initial thought of a person before King Solomon came along and wrote verse 5 over here? In verse 5, he says that it's better to hear the ridicule of a wise man, that they hear the songs of fools.
Wouldn't the Havamina be that we would think that the best thing would be to hear positive words, no matter from who it comes from, but something that makes us feel good, than to hear a truly wise idea that points out our flaws? However, that, the second, is actually much better for us.
Exactly, right. Meaning he's telling you that the person has a tendency to gravitate towards what is emotionally appealing. That's why King Solomon says, no, you're wrong. Don't listen to the song of fools. Listen, prefer the ridicule of a wise person than to just feel emotionally satisfied for the moment. And similarly, when he says that, he says in 6, he says that as is the crackling, the sound of the thorns under the pot, meaning that's thorns notoriously make a crackling sound. So does wood when you put it. We talk about thorns. When you put it under the fire and you use it as fuel to cook your food, so that crackling is synonymous with its destruction. That's what the commentator said. And it's something which destroys the person. He says, so also is the laughter of a fool. Okay, let me just read you. He says, this is Sforno again. He says, as the sound of the thorns that are crackling under the pot. So he says, just like it happens that the sound of the thorns that are burning underneath the pot of meat, and they are destroyed with this sound, right? So you see, he's saying that it's that there is something which is happening. The thorn is not just crackling, but it's being destroyed through the fire. So King Solomon is using that as an analogy. The sound of the thorn is just like the sound of fools that joke around. You might think it's emotionally pleasing, it's fun. But what that actually is doing is, in their act of joking, is their destruction. Just like in the act of a thorn crackling from the fire, it's being destroyed. So he's making an analogy between the sound of the crackling thorn and the sound of the person's laughter. And he says in both cases, there is a destruction that's simultaneously happening. But what's the destruction that's happening when the person jokes around?
He's removing himself from reality and just existing for that period of time in kind of a world of fantasy.
Exactly. And if you read verse 7, it says what you just said, Doug. Because he says in 7, why? Meaning he's explaining of 6 now. Because. Why do I, King Solomon, say this? That the person who laughs and jokes around is just like a thorn that's crackling and being burnt up and consumed? Here's the reason. Because this type of removal from thought, will now make mundane the wise man. It removes him from the area of wisdom. Because when you're involved in this type of just joking around, you're not involved with wisdom. And on top of that, too, you're engendering an attachment to something emotionally pleasing. That's what the rabbis say, every sin causes another sin. Because when a person sins, that now makes a changeover to his soul, and it makes him more attached than he was 2 seconds ago. And now the next sin is even easier and more appealing because he's aggravating. Aggravating also means to entice, to excite. So a person aggravates his a certain emotion, that means he's arousing it up. And now it's going to be harder for him to get back into the world of wisdom. So that's where the destruction comes in, when a person just sits around and they joke around, and there's just, you know, frivolity and worthlessness, just to joke around and make their friends laugh. So it's fun to get a laugh, and you want to be the life of the party. All right, so there's ego involved, but all these different emotions for this momentary pleasure, what they do is it removes you from wisdom. So a person is really intelligent, he enjoys a good laugh, but he does it with wisdom too. He's never outside. He never abandons wisdom. However, when a person is involved in this type of laughter and emotionally appealing and he wants to joke around with others, so now he's not investigating an area. He's not analyzing something. Now his intent is just to evoke a response from his friend. He's now in the social realm. Now the person, his peers, have now become the focus, not an idea. And that's why the end of verse 7 says that it destroys the heart. It was given as a gift. And the person should really view it as a gift. He should view it as something which is of great value.
Rabbi, can I say something?
Yes.
That is such an important point, and it's something that we really should take to heart very seriously, because by not understanding this fully, that's how people end up on the wrong path and into difficulty, because they're making things, they're minimizing the importance of wisdom.
Yes, it's true.
Thank you so much for saying it that way.
Rabbi?
Yep.
So then, should somebody seek out people that are not pleasing in terms of just, I don't know, I guess, like working with people who are difficult, should you, try to learn from that experience and, like, seek it out? I guess I'm wondering if you should seek out people that challenge you, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the Pirkei Avos says that you should make yourself a rabbi, and you should acquire a friend. Meaning that's how much value you should put on a good friend is something that you should even pay for. Make for yourself a rabbi, I say to Rav Kenelech Chaver, and acquire for yourself a friend. So it's definitely true what you're saying, that you should acquire. I mean, we have to be realistic too. I mean, we need jobs, we need to be paid. So to be in a situation where sometimes, it's going to be inevitable that there'll be a peer or a colleague or a friend or a co-worker that is going to be very base in nature, and we just have to be tolerant for those few moments or minutes or whatever it is, because that's the way the world is. We have to understand that there are going to be people like that, so we can't, we have to just be intelligent, as we are in all areas, that although who we socialize with, who we choose to spend time with, and the topics of a conversation, that's in our control. But invariably, somebody's going to bring up a topic or somebody's going to say something and you don't want to hurt feelings. So there's a certain weighing of how you respond, or how sometimes no response is better, or how there's a clever way to change a topic so you don't hear somebody speaking Lashon Hara, that you don't, listen. The famous one is where a person's about to speak really derogatory statements, and somebody yells at, you would say, hey, how about those Yankees? You talk about something that is of equal interest but neutral, and at least it may not be of such great, wisdom, but it'll stop people in the tracks without an insult. So there's ways, or you could sneeze, or you say, oh, I got to get a tissue. You walk out of the room if, somebody's about to speak. A lot of people do that. A lot of their time is spent on deriding other people, which is, a great sin. I think it's Maimonides. My friend told me, says that the three cardinal sins that we have are idolatry, adultery, and murder. And then Maimonides says, but Lashon Hara, evil speech, is equated to all of them, meaning that it has a character of those. It's very severe. So you have to be even-handed. We have to be concerned about hurting people's feelings, and to avoid that, at all costs. At the same time, we have to be concerned about not engaging I would assess that most of the times it's going to be, a minority of cases. And the people who we do associate with on a regular basis are the ones that we value, that they share our views, that we can really enjoy the conversation. and it's going to be something which is intelligent, because that's really what gives us the most satisfaction in life. Now these verses here, I just want to say, I asked you before, why did I stop at the end of 8? See, there is an underpinning to why a person does gravitate to these things, why a person wants to hear the song of fools as opposed to the ridicule and corrective statements of a wise man. Why does a person want to hear the laughter of a fool, as he says in 6? And why does a person gravitate towards, this type of when people are joking around, even though he says in 7, it's going to remove a person who is wise from being involved in wisdom. So the answer is 8. And he says, better is the latter end of something than its beginning. What do I mean to say?
Reminds me a bit of hindsight is 20/20. Being able to look back, you see the reality of something.
Right. And the flip side of the coin is that what Pirkei Avos says is that who is a wise person? One who knows the latter end. What's going to happen at the end? So this means to say that a person who's wise realize what might be temporary and what's going to be permanent. So the beginning of something, not necessarily, he gives an analogy here. One of the, Ibn Ezra, the Ibn Ezra says that a wise man will drink something which is bitter, even though at the beginning it may be harmful to his palate, but at the latter end it could be medicinal and it'll help his body. As opposed to taking something which is sweet, that tastes good at the beginning, but at the end it could hurt him. So he looks at what the outcome is going to be. So these cases we're talking about is where a person wants, he looks at the here and now, the laughter I can be involved in, the song I can hear somebody singing. That's something which at the moment is emotionally satisfying. And that's what King Solomon is telling you. If you have a rule that you live with, and better is the end of something than the beginning, meaning better is what is it going to result in? What is the permanent effects? That's the real way to assess the value of something. And if you have that system that you live with, and that's a reality before your mind's eye, that it's true that how something ends up is really the true value of the thing. So then, wasting time with a guy who's just joking around, it may sound good and all, but it's at the end, that's going to be over. The few moments are dead, and I could have used that time for something else. So that's why he says this at the end of these 3 verses. He gives you the rule at the end. He tells you illustrations, but then he explains to you. But there is a progression, too. There is a progression in the verses as well, because like we said, verse 6 progresses, and it says, and he says that just like the crackling sound of the thorns, so also is the laughter of the fools. But then he explains why. Because. So 7 starts off with the word because. Because what this does is it now excites that emotion, and it also simultaneously removes you from being involved in wisdom, in pursuing the greater benefit for your soul. So there is a progression in the verses, and he explains more as he goes along. But then he finally gives the rule in 8. Where he says, better is the latter end of something than its beginning, even though the emotions would be attached to something at the beginning. And then he says, better is patience than pride. What does that mean? But you can see why that's in this verse, because patience has to do with waiting for the latter end of something. But what's the... what is the connection between patience and pride as opposed to patience and anger or patience and sorrow? What's the connection of patience and pride?
It's seems like when you're looking back at the previous verses, we're talking about things that make you feel good, and pride is one of those things. When people give you compliments and that kind of thing, it makes you feel good, but it's kind of a false reality.
That's interesting. Meaning pride is part of what the enjoyment is. It's me.
Right. Isn't it also an ego thing as well?
You mean when somebody's singing, or what case is ego?
Well, when you have pride, that comes from your ego. And also when you're laughing with your friends, it's because it feels good to your ego.
Right. That's true.
I was thinking, Cal,
right? I think that was an excellent point, because everything that... I think that the ego creates a lot of problems for us if we don't control it. That's why we have no patience. The ego wants to go forward and get the instant gratification, and the patience is trying to hold it back. But if it doesn't succeed, then there's more of a mess to contend with.
It seems like patience has a quality of being undemanding, whereas pride has the opposite quality of demanding recognition of the ego. And a person who is undemanding will be able to be present and satisfied with what he has at a particular moment, whereas someone with a big inflated ego is going to be making demands potentially on reality that reality is not going to give him. And so the person who is patient is actually going to be more at peace than the person who's haughty or prideful in spirit.
So the person in pride, so it seems like you're saying, is that the person is involved in the moment, the ego, and there's impatience, and there's an intolerance, and not an acceptance of reality. And the truth is, you're right, because when a person's focus is a self, so that means his focus can't be reality. And when a person's patient, it's just the opposite. Patience means he's allowing himself to perceive what is going on. So what exactly is patience? Patience is where a person waits for everything. He waits to see the whole picture of something. He understands that what is in front of him right now is not the complete picture. He waits for more information. He waits to see how things might pan out. He waits for the person talking to complete their sentence. He's taking in, he looks at the entire set of facts in front of him and doesn't try to just jump to a conclusion quickly. So that means the person who's patient is one who is perceiving and is interested in acquiring and obtaining more facts. What is true? He's involved in truth. He's searching for truth. That's patience. A person who's pride, who's proud, it's the opposite. He's not a receptacle of information. He's not passive like the person who's patient. He is the aggressor, and he's trying, what is he? He's aggressively trying to push forth his image. So it's just the opposite. That's why the two are together. It's two ends of a spectrum. And I think a lot of you said, you know, the components of that, that this is the certain character that each one of these represent. And again, the reason why it's in the same verse is because the person who's patient waits to see the end of something. He understands that what is immediately in front of him, it's too quick to evaluate. So better off is the end, because that's when I'll see the full picture. That's when I understand reality. So patience and the end of a matter, what they all share together is truth. The truth will eventually, you know, be shown. But that takes time. and therefore patience is a friend to truth. Whereas a person just immediately assesses something at first, so maybe there's a need to, oh, I know already, I have the answer already, and that's ego. Or a person just wants to push forth their own agenda. But a person is really interested in truth, he does not say a word or make an evaluation until he's convinced that he has all the information. That's a person who's seeking truth. The opposite of a person who's seeking the ego.
So, patient person would be outwardly focused, looking at reality, while a prideful person is going to be inwardly focused on their ego.
Right, very well said.
So the first part of the verse, when it says the end of a thing is better than the beginning, isn't saying like, well, your death's better than your birth. It's more about a viewpoint of truth in a situation. Is that what you think he's getting at?
Right, but we did have that verse before that it says better is a day of death than a day of birth. Do you remember we did that?
Yeah, I do.
Right.
Doesn't make me want to die any sooner, though.
No?
No.
No, we definitely want to, you know, accomplish our mission. We definitely want to have the time to perfect ourselves and correct our flaws and be attached to the truth and try to understand whatever we can about reality. To use this one time to, right? That was the 7-1 says that. Right? Better is a good name than fine oil, and better is a day of death than the day of birth. So it is, you know, it's similar to what we're saying here. Although here, I think he's focusing more specifically on the person's attitude should be one where he's not looking for the immediate. And when a person has a very short span of attention or short fuse or he needs instant gratification, that's going to harm him because he's going to be looking for the satisfaction as opposed to be looking for truth. To be immediately satisfied, that means you're catering to yourself and the emotions, and that's what he's saying here. It's better off the end of a thing than the beginning of a thing. But that's the rule, and that's...
And thereby that makes so much sense, because anyone that has experienced seeing a newborn baby, and oh, how delicious, how adorable, how sweet, but we have no clue as to what that little child is going to do with his or her life. And we don't know that until at the very end, unfortunately, the time of death. What, how they spent the time, what they did with their time, what they valued, what they didn't spend time on, the whole thing, the whole picture has to be painted. It's like, it's so important to see that. Thank you for bringing it up, Doug.
Yeah, I think if you take a look at verse 9, which I didn't really go into yet, but look what he says, is do not be excited in your spirit to be angry. Because anger is in the bosom, it rests in the bosom of fools. And I think this continues with the theme about being excited in your spirit to be angry at something. So that's the height of expression of intolerance of reality. As Rabbi Chait explained, why is it that it's considered that anger is considered akin to idolatry? Because idolatry is where a person distorts reality and he says something has certain powers when in fact it doesn't. Anger also is a distortion. It's an attempt to, a person is, it's unacceptable what happened and he gets angry. Anger is an expression of intolerance, and that the person cannot accept what happened. And I think I might have mentioned once there was a story of a rabbi who had all his notes on his table and had a cup of tea there, and somebody sat down, shook the table, and the tea went all over the notes and ruined them. And the rabbi suddenly got up, and then he sat down. What does it mean? It means that initially, all of his work was now, hours or days of work is now lost. But then he accepted reality and he sat down. He held himself back from any expression. Sometimes you can't help but an emotional knee-jerk response is going to happen, and we're not really you know, that's not something which we're so accountable for when an emotion overtakes us. Rabbi Chaim explained that as well, that when a person is overwhelmed by an emotion and he acts a certain way wrongfully, he's not held as accountable as when it's something premeditated. So, but this rabbi caught himself right away. He stood up very quick for a second, but then he recognized what he was doing. It was an outlet of anger was about, but he nipped it in the bud, and he sat right down, and he controlled himself. He accepted the reality. The notes are gone, and that is it. So a person, he should not be excited with his spirit to be angry. Why? Because anger is a sign of a fool. Anger sits in the bosom. What does it mean it sits in the bosom of a fool? It means that it's a close friend to the fool. A person who is a fool is somebody who, why is he foolish? Foolish means that he's not intelligent. That's the opposite of foolishness is intelligence. So a fool is somebody who's stupid. Where does his stupidity come from? It comes from the fact that he's not looking outwardly, as Doug said. He's not looking to examine the external world, but he's functioning on internal. This went against what my wishes are right now, and he's angry, and therefore he's always pushing his agenda, and he's never educating himself. Because it's the self that's the focus, as opposed to the external world. So you see how this, verse 9, this follows on the coattails of this string of verses here. Okay. All right, so maybe we'll wrap it up over here, but I think maybe next week we should just go over it again, because we did a number of verses, and I don't think we did full credit to each one individually. So maybe we'll look over it during the week and see if you see more questions or nuances or commentaries that might shed more light on this. And then let's try to flesh out any other points so we really get a thorough understanding of each verse. Understand it the best we can. We shouldn't rush through it. But I just saw that these were all related, and I didn't plan even on going into 9, but looking at it, we see that it is related. So what we should do next week is come back and review 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. All right? Let me just stop here and see if there's any other last questions or comments.
Good here. Thank you, Rabbi. Excellent stuff.
Oh, thank you. Can't do it without you. And again, it was good seeing you and Cal and Josh. And hopefully, you know, Jim and Francesca, Tina and Naomi will meet soon, too.
That'd be great. That was fun. Yeah. Hope to do it again.
Yeah. It'd be good. Rivka, did I answer all your questions?
Rabbi, yes, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much. And, you know, I appreciate also the questions that, like Doug and Cal and Francesca, that when they ask the questions and it brings out more information because you have to expound on it. So it's such a wonderful thing. I enjoy the class so much. Thank you, everybody.
All right, so I wish everybody a good week. We'll pick up next week, same time. We'll go over these verses, all right? And then we'll see if we'll go further.
Sounds good.
And again, yeah, feel free during the week, you know, if there's any other issues that come up, you know, drop an email or a phone, whatever. It doesn't have to be just once a week. Okay?
Rabbi, may I?
Jim, go ahead.
Yes, I'm sorry. May I mention that some time ago we had a question about... I'm blanking on the question exactly how it was read, but I asked something about causing other generations, further generations, to have, to keep the Torah, to have the obligation, and we never did get background to answering the question.
Yeah, Rabbi Mann had answered that, and I had actually, you know, Rabbi Shea has been busy, so I sent an email to his wife, and hopefully at some point I'll discuss it with him. But Rabbi Mann did feel that the obligation was to keep the Torah was accepted by the Jews on behalf of all future generations. And that's what the verses say, that not only with you, I think it's in the beginning of Parshas Nitzavim, I have it here.
God says, I'm not making this treaty just with you today that are standing here, or those who are not here today. I mean to say it's going to be a perpetual obligation. I guess we could still go into what is the justice in that.
I had kind of an idea on that. Because the obligation on future generations be, because of the future generations are the recipients of the historical proof of Sinai. So therefore, they're also obligated, and because of that.
Well, if God had asked, seriously, God presented it to the Jews and they accepted, there seemed to be a dialogue, an acceptance, an offer, and they accepted. So if they were given that opportunity, unless that's not true, unless that was just something at Sinai, but now later on, 40 years later, in Deuteronomy 29:14, or actually 13 and 14, it says, and not only you alone do I cut this agreement today and this curse today, but those that are before you and also those that are not standing here today do I make this agreement. Right? It says Deuteronomy 29, 13 and 14. So if you want, we can revisit and go further and probe that. But why, Josh, would you say that that would impose an obligation on future generations?
Yeah, let's think about it. Yeah,
if you want, ask Rabbi Mann. You'll probably see Rabbi Mann later on today or tomorrow, so you could put that to him.
Yeah.
And get a
specific. Did you say you already asked him?
I did ask him, but if you want it for clarification, maybe you could bring that up and have that for us next week. You could elucidate that for us.
Okay. Yeah, because I guess the real question is, like, how can, how can the Jews at the time of Sinai, like, speak for their descendants, I guess?
Right.
Yeah, it's one thing they take on themselves, but how can they say, going to take it on, all future generations, and the future generations, those at the time had the choice, they're taking on for future generations without them having any say in it, right?
Right, that's the question. How is it that I'm obligated based on what somebody accepted, 2,500 years ago?
Right.
I mean, the fact that I'm obligated is that if I do something wrong and there's a the courts find me guilty, they can put me to death for doing something, or they could fine me, or whatever the thing is. Why can't I argue, hey, I never accepted the system? So what could be the possible response to that? But you'll keep in mind that God did not give Adam or Eve an option. He said, don't eat from this, and if you do eat from this, that day you'll become mortal. There was no option. There was no option by the other seven laws also. The other six laws also by Noah. So which way is it?
I was going to say that. Yeah.
So which way is it?
The same thing. I mean, Noah didn't have a choice.
Right. So maybe we have a misunderstanding as to what happened at Sinai when the Jews said, we will do and we will listen. Perhaps there wasn't an option. That's what we have to get to. And
it doesn't say, how the... there's a midrash, that God held Sinai above them or something, right? It says, accepted or else, right?
Well, that's a midrash. That means to say that it was so overwhelmingly, the proof of God's existence at Sinai was so overwhelming, it was like they didn't have free choice. It was as if a mountain,
right.
It was as if a mountain was held over their head.
Right. So, could you say the same thing for... I'm not totally clear. It's kind of my idea earlier. Like the future generations of the Jews, it's because they're the recipients of the of the proof of Sinai. It's the same for them that
you know what I mean? The reality of the thing is the same for them as it was for those that were there, because they're recipients of the historical proof.
You mean to say that the reality for us today is no less, even though we didn't see it visually? We know from proof that it happened. We know historically this event took place. That's true,
yeah.
but the question is, at that event, was there an option? We're not talking about the
event. Yeah. What was that?
I'm just saying, at the event, was there an option? That's the question. I mean, the thing which strikes me also is that, I mean, how does a person who's a creation of God say, thanks, but I'm not going to keep the Torah? So it's like a person, he wants to have his body and all of his lusts and pleasures, which God made, but he doesn't want the other part. To me, that's a contradiction. Just if you think about it just naturally. So it would be a contradiction for a person to say, I don't want the Torah system, because why does a person say that? Because he wants to be free to enjoy this body and his desires. But 1 minute, that God created that as well. So do you want, you should really be thinking, do you want existence or not? So if a person is going to accept his existence, he has to accept everything that goes along with it. And to me, that would mean that there is no option. And maybe when certain ideas were presented to the Jews, it wasn't as an option. And their response was not the response to a question. Moses never says to them, here's an option, do you want the Torah or not? That you don't see in the Torah. So when the Jews do say, we will do and we will listen, that is not a response to a question. It's just a praise to the Jews that they saw the system as being so provable that they said, we'll do. But we're not going to just follow it blindly. Of course, we're going to use intelligence because we see that it's necessary. So that's a praise, and the Talmud talks about that. It was as if they were given two crowns on their heads when they said those two words. Because there were two praises. Number one, they realized the truth of the system. And number two, they recognized the use of intelligence was necessary. They're not just going to blindly follow. But it wasn't an option. Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
I'm sorry, then what about the convert?
What about it?
Well, the convert does consciously make a choice then to opt into a full Torah observance, and his children become obligated.
Well, that's true. That's a good question. You mean, because the convert, without converting, still has obligations, still has the Noahide laws that he has to do, and that's not an option.
There could be too. I mean, the obligation to keep the Noahide laws is, one more. It's the person is created by God as a person. So they're kind of obligated to keep God's laws, for human beings. But that B'nai Israel was. They were made a nation by God, and they were brought out of Egypt. And so really, God made them a separate people. So to be part of that people, they're kind of obligated in the same way, because they wouldn't be a people unless, God specifically made them that way, with the whole Torah system. Does that make any sense? So a convert, when he joins this people, then, it's the same thing.
You're saying that once he joins the Jewish nation, so then now it's the all that applies to the nation applies to him. He's no different anymore. So the fact that he chose it is really irrelevant now that he is a Jew. And the truth is, a convert can't change back. I hear where you're going with that, yeah.
Yeah, but my point about the convert is that he does choose it for further generations.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't just choose it for himself. If Israel didn't at Sinai, well, that's one thing, but the convert still does choose for him and his generation.
Well, now he's no different than the Jew. He's basically the Jew at this point. once it converts.
Yeah.
So now he's a Jew, and a Jew, by definition, has this obligation. So it goes back to that question. I mean, it wouldn't be that. I mean, the truth is, it's sort of like that fact that he converted is sort of like lost in the wash, because now his descendants are no different than a Jew. So now his descendants take on the same role that took place over here at Deuteronomy, where they entered in. I mean, the truth is, it still has to be explored, because there were a couple of different times that God created a treaty with the Jews. There was at Sinai, and then there was here. But here, now it included curses. I mean, now they're entering to the land, there was something new happened. So what we have to do is really get to the core of this. I mean, if you want, I can research this, and we could do this next week. I think it's important.
Yeah, I'll try to ask Reverend Mann sometime this week. And
okay, good. Jim, you said
something.
Okay, Josh, good. And I think, Jim, you had something else you wanted to say, Jim?
No, I was just saying that I'm very interested, but I don't want to derail anything either.
No, learning is learning. We're not derailing. And it may not be a lot of time either, but God willing, I'll try to get back on track with this, and maybe I'll reach out to Rabbi Chait again and see what his thoughts are on it. Because there's a lot of parts to it. There's a lot of events that contribute to this or this question, you know. Okay, so if I find out more, I'll share it with you all next week. Or I'll send something out on the Noahides list. I mean, I hope everybody's on that. So I assume that everybody here is on that list. Jim, are you on that list, the email list?
Yes, I am, sir.
Okay, good. All right, well, I think a number of you have gone to Rabbi Moskowitz's class, so let me not detain you. I think it starts in about 6 minutes. So have a good week, and we'll pick it up again next week.
All right, thanks, Rabbi.